Ms. Schwendiger's work lives in at least two worlds, sometimes assertive and rhythmically sharp-edged, but those moments virtually always resolve into a sweetly singing line. The grittier orchestral writing offsets that sweetness without overwhelming it. This is a work that seems likely to blossom with repeated listening. So said New York Times music critic Alan Kozin of Chiaroscuro Azzurro, a work for violin and orchestra by Laura Schwendinger. It's an observation that could apply to many of the composer's works, and we're going to explore a few of them with the composer. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. Laura Schwendinger has written in many genres and has won many distinctions. She was the first composer to win the American Academy in Berlin Prize, and her opera Artemisia is the winner of the 2023 American Academy of Arts and Letters Charles Ives Opera Award, the largest such award for vocal music in the United States. She's also a professor of composition at the UW-Madison, and welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you so much, Norman, for having me.
I'm looking forward to exploring the many faceted world of your music. And I think first we should get into some idea as to how you got into this business in the first place. It's one thing to be an instrumentalist, of course. It's another to compose, and still another to prosper so mightily as a composer. So take us back to the beginning. How did it all start?
Well, the beginning, I guess, was when I was fairly young. I was making up tunes when I was about 6, 7, 8 years old, and I started writing little pieces for the youth orchestras that I played in the Bay Area. And when I applied to the San Francisco Conservatory as a senior in high school, I applied as a flute major. I didn't apply with my compositions, but I sent in some of these youth orchestra pieces that I'd written. And John Adams wrote me a little note saying, "I've seen your pieces. Please come to the conservatory and work with me.
Wow.
I'd like you to study with me."
Important composer.
So I double majored there. But slowly but surely, it was clear that composition was going to be calling me forward.
When you compose, who are you thinking about? Are you thinking about what you want to express? Are you thinking about the performers? Are you thinking about the audience?
It's different for different pieces. One of the pieces that I may share with you today, Nightingales, we heard a little bit of it maybe at the beginning, was started because I had a student named Eleanor Barsh, who's an alumnus of UW-Madison and is an extraordinarily gifted performer. And I've written other pieces for her, but we talked for a while about maybe doing a concerto at some point. And so thus Nightingales was born, and it was born out of wanting to write her a piece that would really show off her virtuosity. And then the marriage with my obsession with birds during COVID really had a huge effect on things. I stayed sane by looking out my back window and looking at the birds and transcribing bird calls.
Oh, that must have been fun.
So I kept a little journal of all the different bird calls, and I tried to identify all of them. I couldn't identify all of them. But a lot of those birds from my backyard are in this piece.
Not the first time by any means that birds have inspired music. I mean, going all the way back to, the 17th century and probably before that, if we knew imitation sonatas and imitation of bird calls, and then the time you get to the 20th century with Respighi and is it the Pines of Rome?
Of course,
certainly,
yeah.
We have gramophone recordings of birds worked into the thing. But you must have been aware of all of that when you wrote your birds into your pieces.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And there are some little kind of winks and nods to Messiaen in the piece because he's really the man who made all of this possible in a way.
Let's get into some of this music then. We started out with the aptly named Nightingales, the beginning of that. And what sort of work is that?
That work is a piece for two violin soloists and orchestra.
What do you use for the bird calls then?
Oh, well, the violin soloists do all sorts of wonderful effects that recall these bird calls. But there are also a lot of little nifty gadgets in the percussion section that are used, including a nightingale bird call from England, actually from Acme Bird Call Company.
Now, we mentioned in the beginning there your opera, Artemisia. And what's the premise behind that?
Well, Artemisia Gentileschi was a famous painter, and she was a follower of Caravaggio and used the same techniques that he did. Very brightly shone faces with a dark background, so you feel the weight of the body coming out of the darkness. So her father was a very famous painter as well, and he raised her to learn how to paint, and she became a painter in his studio. And at the tender age of 17, people already knew who she was. She already was known as being kind of this Wunderkind. And unfortunately, one of the people he hired to teach her about perspective, Agostino Tassi, raped her. And it was kind of the trial of the century because her father had Tassi put on trial. You could call for that in those days. And he was put on trial. And after a very long watched trial in which Artemisia's fingers were broken during torture to verify her testimony.
Was that a common thing then?
Yes, it was. The Inquisition.
Oh, of course.
They were lovely people. That's what it was. but, you know, as a painter, having your fingers broken was no small thing.
Sure.
But she verified her testimony in such a way that Tassi was found guilty. And he never served. He was able to, like, buy his way out of serving.
Didn't get any fingers broken.
No, and didn't get any fingers broken. But he was found guilty, so her honor was restored by this in the eyes of her father and of the people of that time. And from there, she painted for King Charles in England. She painted for dukes and duchesses and you know, every major figure you can think of, she painted for.
And you're turning then the story of a painter into an opera.
We do. We take Tableau Vivant of her famous paintings. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And these Tableau Vivant are really almost autobiographical because she painted her face into many of the paintings. And of course, she paints her own face as Judith. And Tassi's face is Holofernes.
She's definitely working through things, isn't she?
She's
in her
working,
paintings.
She is. And she was brave in that way. And, yeah, she's an incredible figure. Anyway, we surmise, we don't know exactly how she died. She might have died in a plague that went through her area in those years. But she also wrote a letter, and we have all the letters, by the way, that she wrote her patron wrote her. We also have the transcripts of the trial. They still exist in Italy.
That's a wealth of information to work with if you're going to write an opera on the subject.
Exactly. And my librettist did all this wonderful research. And we surmise that she was losing her eyesight because she asks her patron, Don Ruffo, for monies for a procedure of some sort. And during that period of time, cataract surgery was quite common. You know, Bach and Handel are said to have died from complications to that surgery.
It was not a good time for certain medical procedures. Well, let's hear some of this before we get a little bit more into the arc of the story and set us up some excerpts or two from your opera.
Well, the first one I've prepared for you is an aria, and it's about her singing through this canvas that is a self-portrait of allegory as art. She sings gold, it needs more gold. And what she is trying to do is brighten up the image because she is her eyesight starting to fail. Then the second excerpt, which follows that, is an aria that her assistant Tommaso sings, and he has a case for Artemisia. He's in love with her secretly. All operas need that in some way or
yes.
shape or form, and so he's singing about his master who is having a difficult time with her painting because of this thing that
eyesight.
She's experienced.
And so what is this first excerpt called?
It's an aria? It's called the Gold Aria. And after that, it's Tommaso's aria.
Thank you. Christian light and extra love. A specialist is what you need. I know an oculist who can help. Who can
help? Tell him to come on Tuesday.
On Tuesday.
On Tuesday.
Must be a wonderful piece for the harpist and some of the others involved too, but how many times does the harpist get to be so effective?
Oh, yeah. And in this production, there were two harps and a lute.
Oh.
A large tiarbo.
Never heard of that combination.
Yeah. We used this aria of Barbara Strozzi's, who was a composer during that time.
17th century.
Yeah. And the opera starts with her aria. And then it moves into a chorus that takes the words from her aria and they go off with it. Che si può fare, which means what can be done, which is the overall effect of the opera, which is, you know, if you're losing your eyesight and your pain or what happens next, you know, that kind of thing.
Sure.
Yeah. So the next example we're going to hear is This is the Ring You Gave Me, which is what Artemisia sings during her torture. And some of the words from this particular aria come from the transcripts of the trial. Artemisia famously said, "What I have said is true. All is true." And that is a famous quotation from her. And so this is quite an intense excerpt where she's singing in the court. She's quite angry. She's looking directly at Tosi. "This is the ring you gave me. This is the promise that you made." And but the rings in this case are the sibyls, which are the way that she was tortured.
Thank you.
she is truthful. Oh, see, a court finds you guilty.
Very effective at creating this reverie and dreamlike remembrance effect for Artemisia.
Yeah, she's remembering these horrible, you know, moments of her life. And at the end, Tommaso says, "Madam, wake up." He's trying to wake her out of this past moment and reliving it, you know. Late in her life, she's kind of thinking about this past and the arc of her life.
Performances of this opera, when and where have they taken place?
Oh, there have been six different productions. This production is the Trinity Wall Street production with Trinity Novus, which is a very fine orchestra in New York. And Trinity has a lot of money, so the production was really something. We got to work with Lydia Yanoskotsvaya, you know, who conducts in Chicago, and Christopher Alden, who is the is a famous opera director, and all the singers were Metropolitan Opera singers, people like Richard Troxell and Augusta Cazzo, an amazing cast.
It would take an amazing cast, I think, to really make it its best. I mean, it could be a tough opera to sing, right?
Oh, yeah. It's a difficult opera. And, you know, the opera matches, I think, in tone, the bravery and the difficulty and the beauty in different ways of the painting. So I tried to match that complexity because her work is really, it's very, very interesting and complex. And there are many layers.
We're going to look, speaking of many layers and complexity, at the music in other contexts of composer Laura Schwendinger when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with composer Laura Schwendinger, who is also a professor of composition at the UW-Madison and a multiple award-winning composer. And we've been listening to excerpts from her opera, Artemisia. And we have looked at a lot of varying textures, a lot of complexity, layers of things going on, storyline included. At some point in this opera, Laura, you have to tie it all together for an ending. And how do you do that?
Well, Norman, she sings this aria about the moon, and she comes out of that reverie realizing that she's going to lose her eyesight. And so she makes the decision to stop painting the Diana that she's been painting. And she says, never mind. I'm not going to paint this naked Diana. She had a thing about painting lots of naked ladies. She didn't want to after a while. It got to be a little bit old. And she says, anyway, the oculist is coming to take me away soon to an uncertain future. And then the chorus comes in and sings this Che si può fare, this what can be done. And from that, then the soprano ends the entire thing with a little bit of this Barbara Strozzi aria. And we will hear her accompanied by the lute.
I will paint an Artemis to my own taste. I have shown what Actaeon sees.
What Actaeon sees.
Darkness and pain.
That lute and the soprano, very effective and in a very unusual way, seems to me, of ending an opera, especially one with so much power.
Yeah, well, you know, I had this conceit that choosing a female painter needed the female composer of the period. So I found this beautiful aria by Barbara Strozzi, Che si può fare. And the beginning of the opera also starts with this same aria, and it overlaps with my overture. So the two live in the same world for a while. It's almost like one of those montages in the films where we get into the scene through the memory, in this case, and through the sensory world of the orchestra. And the ending, the same way, we come out. So we hear the choir overlap the lute. The lute accompanies them for a short spell, and then the Barbara Strozzi comes in to end all.
And those lovely Italian words in the aria are saying what? Are they related to the plot line of the opera?
Absolutely. Che si può fare translates literally to what can be done. And that's the premise of the opera. What can be done? If you're an artist and you lose your eyesight, you know, how do you paint? So, yeah.
It's like I say, it's a great way to end an opera on such a quiet note. And then, of course, you have to have that fermata of silence at the end of it before the audience responds. And it's, very effective that
way. They turned off the lights. The director had them turn off the lights completely. And we just sat in darkness.
We call that radio. We love that, too.
Oh, it's lovely.
Well, speaking of lovely, you know, we have heard quite a bit of variety of style in your work so far, Laura. And we had something that was almost, I wouldn't say a mad scene earlier on, but as close perhaps as this opera gets to it. Mm. On the other hand, though, you have to be able to put in a nice kind of love duet.
Yeah.
Now, if not in this opera, where might we find one in the works of Laura Schwendinger?
Well, our second opera, which was just done this last spring before the last summer in Houston, Texas, by a group called Musiqua, is called Cabaret of Shadows. And it's about that end of the 19th to 20th century period, the fin du siècle. And it's in places like the Folies Bergères, where you have women creators. And these women creators are finding their voice in these places where they're allowed to do their work. Because if they're out there in the bourgeoisie world, or if they're a working girl, they have to work on the streets. If they're in the family house, they have to cook and clean and all of that sort of stuff. And these women didn't want to live that life.
So and people, this is Paris we're talking about, so anything goes.
Anything goes. And people like Yvette Guilbert, the famous singer that Toulouse-Lautrec painted many, many times, she's actually a character in our opera. And Gab Soiré, who was a producer and whose life partner was Louis Fuller, who was a very famous dancer, was the progenitor of Isadora Duncan. Mm. And she danced with these large sheets of fabric, and she did these swirls. She was almost like a blossoming flower on stage.
Sounds like Isadora Duncan.
Yeah, exactly. And she was friends with Madame Curie, and they experimented with radium against the fabric so she would glow in the dark on stage. Yeah, she died of cancer.
Yeah, I was going to say, as it turns out, not a great idea, but very exciting to look at while it lasted.
Exactly. And she was a sensation in Paris. People would come from all over to see Louis Fuller dance. She was an American, actually. She was from the Chicago area. So So this duet that we're going to listen to is Gab Soiré, who's the MC for our night in this kind of cabaret of the mind. And she's singing about her lost love, Louis Fuller. And Louis Fuller died a number of years earlier than kind of the setting of this opera. But she still is haunted by the loss of her great love.
So this is from your opera, Cabaret of Shadows. Love to it.
Thank you.
And that is from Cabaret of Shadows, a love duet, we're calling it, and it's the work of Laura Schwendinger, as is all the music we've been hearing so far this hour. And we're going to be hearing some more, too, right after this, here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Meanwhile, back at your second opera that you collaborated on, which we have already sampled some of, that's Cabaret of Shadows, a love duet. There's also a song in there that is known as Yvette's Song. And what is Yvette singing about?
Well, Yvette Guilbert was a famous chanteuse during this period of time, one that Toulouse-Lautrec had a, well, they say maybe a relationship with, but he painted her many times. And every poster you can think of that was on, you know, walls in the 60s from that period, you know, from the 20s, bringing back that whole, that feeling, have Yvette Guilbert in them. She had, you know, wild red hair and she wore these big hats and she was very thin and very tall. And she had this, you know, statuesque image, but she was also funny. She was a little bit of a comedian in her acts. And Yvette Guilbert is singing this song about how the soldier is returning from war. And it's a very dark song. He comes back from the war and his guts are hanging in his hand. And finally you find out he's been buried outside of the home. And so it's that kind of twisted French sense of the cabaret where they're dark things. But it's all accompanied by a French styled musette that I wrote. So you hear this very light music in the orchestra around her, and she's singing these dark words.
Oh, that kind of contrast can be very effective.
Thank you.
That's it. Charming little finale there. It's kind of like, oop, we're done. We're almost done, but I'd like to get in some more of your music from other places in particular that we haven't touched on. And you have this dance for harp in Second Sight. And what's the context for that?
Well, that's a harp concerto. It was written for Elizabeth Ramey Johnson, who's the principal of the Atlanta Symphony. And Emory University commissioned me just recently to write a concerto for her to celebrate their 100th anniversary of orchestra programs there. And so this dance is one of the tiny movements. There are seven small movements that make up this concerto. And this movement's about a minute and a half. But it's a dance. It's a recognizable dance.
Thank you.
And we just have time for one more. Now, we started with nightingales. We heard the first, about a minute of that with the bird sounds and all of that. How does it end?
Well, it ends with a lot of crazy bird bombast. That's how it is.
All right.
Yeah, the birds go pretty insane, and all heck breaks loose. The brass gets some good chords, and then out of that comes a certain. The ending has this certain stillness that just leaves this kind of chord. And it's something I didn't mention before, but nightingales is also an answer in a way to the unanswered question by
hives. So
because,
appropriate.
Boy, I thought about that through COVID so much. And so the piece asks a lot of questions. In the end, we just get a chord, very much like the hives.
Quite an effective piece, the finale of Nightingales. Very atmospheric finale for Nightingales.
Oh, thank you so much, Norman.
It's been a pleasure, Laura Schwendinger.
Oh, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. It's always a pleasure.
And I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.